Hello, this is Janice Schweizer with the Pantograph for Tuesday, September 30th, 2025. We will begin with a short summary of what's happening in the local news. K-pop theme for skate event. The Bloomington Ice Center will host a K-pop themed open skate event from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on Friday, October 3rd. The family-friendly event will feature South Korean pop music and photo opportunities. Concessions will be available for purchase. All ages are welcome and registration is not required. Admission is $7. Skate rental is $3. This open skate is the perfect evening for K-pop music lovers and families looking for easy fun on a Friday night, said Lindsay Danner, Bloomington Ice Center Assistant Manager and Skating Director, in a news release. We hope to see a lot of singing and dancing on the ice. Visit bloomingtonicecenter.org or call 309-434-2877 for more information. Illinois State fans can get an early taste of basketball season Wednesday as Uptown Normal hosts the third Ballin' on Beaufort Block Party. The free event runs from 5 to 8 p.m. along East Beaufort Street. A happy hour starts at 5 p.m., followed by player introductions and contests at 6:30 p.m. on a temporary ISU-branded court. East Beaufort Street between Linden Avenue and Uptown Circle will close to traffic at 11 a.m. on Wednesday and remain closed until about 10 p.m. Parking on that stretch will be prohibited starting at 10 a.m. Apple cider floats, fall bouquets, and wagon rides are among the attractions planned on October 5th at Gale's Pumpkin Patch. The family-owned Logan County business will host its Floats and Flowers event from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Pumpkin Patch at 1709 2000th Avenue in Beeson. Admission is free. Subtle stems of Minier will have fall flowers available to make a bouquet, which can be arranged in either a pumpkin or a jar. For more information, visit galespumpkinpatch.com or email gale@galespumpkinpatch.com, or you can call 217-447-3409. And the Bloomington Public Library at 205 East Olive Street will be closed Tuesday, September 30th, for staff development. That's today. The library's bookmobile will not make any stops on Tuesday. The library will reopen at 9 o'clock a.m. Wednesday, October 1st. Next, then, on the front page, we have Storyteller Steve Vogel Shares His Own by D. Jack Alkery with Lee.net. Steve Vogel, like all journalists, is a collector of stories. Over his 22 years in radio broadcasting, nearly two decades of media relations and speech writing at State Farm insurance companies, and a brief yet unique time in the Army, Vogel has garnered a wide-ranging collection. His repertoire includes reflections from a childhood farmhouse, banquets with dignitaries, quiet conversations while traveling across Europe, and even the panic of nearly violating Federal Communications Commission regulations thanks to a foul-mouthed radio caller. Those tales and dozens more pack the pages of Vogel's newest book, Broadcast Live, 71 True Stories, including some I'd just as soon forget. Obviously, I don't have any celebrity or anything like that, but I've got stories to tell, said Vogel, who is also the author of the New York Times bestseller, Reasonable Doubt, about the 1983 murders of Susan Hendricks and her three young children in their Bloomington home. I've always been a storyteller, collecting other people's stories and telling them, Vogel said. And so now I'm telling some of my own, partly to entertain, but also to inspire. The self-published work is available locally at Barnes & Noble and Boz Bay Books and online via links on his website, stevevogelauthor.com. The new book is organized in five sections, chronicling periods of Vogel's life, from his childhood to military service, work in journalism, professional career, and retirement. Each chapter focuses on a theme or important moment that he found entertaining or could have an emotional or meaningful effect on the reader. One experience I probably would not like to relive is chapter 13, about what happens when you're in a cart behind a donkey that's been in fresh pasture, the author said, chuckling. On the other hand, there's a chapter about my proudest moment, which is one I do not want to forget. And that's chapter 39, when I was chairman of the Big Central Illinois Welcome Home Veterans Parade. Comprehensive though it is, Vogel said his book should not be taken as a compendium of his greatest achievements. This is not an autobiography, he says. I say it's almost a memoir. It's really a collection of stories from a pretty interesting life lived in pretty interesting times. If all goes well, my grandchildren's grandchildren will be able to find it on a shelf at the library one day. One key element throughout the book is life's intersections, Vogel said. Intersection, where you come to a point in your life where suddenly things come together, either by chance or by design, he explained. Someone enters your life or you make a choice, and that's the way you go. One section of the book, Critical Intersections, features reflections on parts of Vogel's military career that kept him out of the Vietnam War. There are several intersections in there that could be life and death for me, given the fact that I probably would not have been a good soldier in Vietnam, Vogel said. While attending Northwestern University to earn his master's degree in journalism, Vogel was sent to cover the happenings in Washington, D.C. in 1968. The tumultuous year saw assassinations of both Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy. Vogel received his Army draft notice the following year. Recalling the circumstances in Chapter 27, he said a fortuitous connection with an Army major in the nation's capital ultimately kept him from the jungles of Vietnam. During basic training, he sent a letter to the major, sharing his location and expected graduation date. When the day came for orders, instead of a rifleman position, Vogel was sent to the John F. Kennedy Center for Special Warfare as a journalist. Another major theme throughout Broadcast Live is a feeling of relevance, Vogel said. I think that's part of the motivation of writing this book. I've always had a thirst for relevance, and I guess leaving stories behind is a part of that. Vogel's earliest journalism days were writing for the Teen Graph, a special section of the Pantograph that employed students from local high schools to report and publish on Saturdays. But the majority of his time reporting local news was on the radio. Because so much of my career was spent in broadcasting, you become cognizant of the fact that your work just disappears into the ether, he said. He wanted to capture in print some highlights from his broadcast career, like the time he brought together Betty Friedan and Phyllis Schlafly for a live discussion. Friedan supported women's liberation, but Schlafly staunchly opposed it. The two women juggernauts on opposite sides of the Equal Rights Amendment and the women's liberation movement had never met face-to-face before Vogel sat them down together. In Chapter 35, Vogel recounted the tense exchange in which Friedan asserted that Schlafly should be burned at the stake. The moment would eventually be reenacted in the TV series Mrs. America. Another politically significant moment came when Vogel invited on his show two men with opposite views of the morality of rock and roll. Paul Kantner, a co-founder of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame group Jefferson Starship, and Reverend Wesley Eights, a Pentecostal minister known for burning albums from the genre, had a much more cordial encounter than Friedan and Schlafly, according to Vogel. In fact, Vogel wrote that the matter was jovial in nature, with the two sharing jokes and discussing how to better help their communities together. After 41 years in the workforce, Vogel retired officially. He quickly returned to his roots, writing a weekly column for the Pantograph for some 200 Saturdays from 2012 to 2017. While the experience was nothing like his work as a daily broadcaster, it still afforded him an avenue to share what he felt was interesting and relevant. One of the pleasures I get is finding that my stories evoke people to remember their own stories, Vogel said. Reminding readers of similar experiences often sparks further discussion. That conversation is needed now more than ever. I think there's a lot to be gained these days for people to put down the phone and talk face to face and find out that we're more alike than we are different. Also on the front page, we have state law aims to aid public defenders. Attorneys say cases overwhelm local offices. Christopher Ticknor sat at a table shuffling papers inside a courtroom in Champaign County. Over the next 90 minutes, the assistant public defender would handle case after case for defendants being arraigned on an array of charges. A man accused of domestic battery, another with aggravated driving under the influence, another with breaking into a car. As the cases were being called, Ticknor greeted the brother of a woman charged with retail theft. He shook hands with a man whose wrists were shackled, wanted on an out-of-state drug warrant. Inside the cavernous and mostly empty courtroom, much of the action was on a large screen television as Ticknor's clients appeared through a video feed from the Champaign County Jail. Associate Judge Brett Olmsted addressed the defendants one by one, explaining what they'd been charged with and informing them of the potential penalties they faced. The judge also made clear that they could continue to be represented by Ticknor and the county and the county's public defender's office, an outcome that seemed likely for many and would inevitably add more cases to the thousands handled by the Champaign County Public Defender's Office, underscoring Ticknor's belief that he and his team of 16 other lawyers could use some more help. "I tend to feel pretty good if I keep things at 100 clients," he said after court about his personal caseload. "If I wanted to talk to every single one of my clients over the course of a week, I could give each one of them 20 minutes, and that would be with a 50-hour week." A new state law recently signed by Governor J.B. Pritzker could eventually ease the workloads for county public defenders' offices, which represent people who cannot afford to hire private lawyers. The law, dubbed by supporters as the Funded Advocacy and Independent Representation Act, or FAIR Act, calls for the creation of a statewide public defender's office to support under-resourced county-level public defenders. The new state office would provide access to more attorneys, forensic experts, paralegals, and other office staff members to help address resource disparities between public defenders and county prosecutors. While the Illinois Attorney General's Office occasionally provides assistance to states' attorneys' offices across Illinois, there's no statewide equivalent for public defenders. What's more, financial disparities between the two sides are pronounced. Cook County's 2024 budget, for instance, provided $102 million for its public defender's office and close to $205 million for the state's attorney. Signed into law last month, the FAIR Act coincides with the implementation of sweeping changes within Illinois' criminal justice system under the 2021 Safety, Accountability, Fairness, and Equity Today Act, also known as the SAFE-T Act. Due to that law's elimination of cash bail, public defenders are in especially high demand as new complex hearings occur soon after defendants are charged and judges determine whether someone charged with a crime should be detained or released while awaiting trial. The new state office will help, said Champaign County's chief public defender, Elizabeth Pollock, who added that the colloquial opinion that county public defenders are too overworked is true. "Everyone agrees that the workload is crushing," she said. "There's just far too many cases per individual public defender. We feel like we can't give the clients the attention that they deserve and need, and it feels like you're just constantly under attack, that there's just a barrage of work to be done, and it never slows down, it never ends. A lot of our clients have issues that have led them to become involved in the criminal justice system. For example, homelessness, substance abuse, disorders, mental health struggles," Pollock said. "We are not built to handle all of the societal ills that affect our clients." But if we're really looking at trying to reduce involvement in the criminal justice system and prevent recidivism amongst our client base, then we need to address the whole person, and we really don't have the resources to do that. The process for creating the new statewide public defender's office is expected to begin next summer when an 11-member public defender commission will be established and choose a statewide public defender to serve as a 6-year term. The governor will appoint 4 people to the commission, while the Illinois Supreme Court will select 3. And the 4 legislative leaders, the Democratic and Republican leaders of the Illinois House and Senate, will each have 1 pick, according to the law. Commission members must have experience defending indigent clients and cannot have been paid as a judge, elected official, prosecutor, judicial officer, police official, or have been employed by those individuals within 2 years preceding their appointment. The state Supreme Court would select an initial statewide public defender who would serve a 2-year term after the law takes full effect on January 1, 2027, while the commission establishes itself and eventually selects subsequent office holders to a full 6-year term. That initial 2-year period promises to be critical for establishing a framework for the office, according to Stephanie Coleman, Policy Director of Northwestern University's Children and Family Justice Center. While the bureaucracy is clearly laid out in the legislation, the same can't be said of funding the new office. One legislative sponsor estimated it would cost only about $1 million annually to run, while some advocates said it could need hundreds of millions of dollars each year to function properly. The state's budget provides $10 million for statewide public defense support across most of the state's 102 counties. There needs to be a lot more work done in order to determine what the areas of highest needs are and how those needs are expressed in terms of resources, personnel, and dollars, said Coleman, who helped push for the FAIR Act. And then on top of that, there will be a continuing conversation about state funding and the role of it in public defense, and that is something that will need to continue for many years. State law has traditionally required county public defenders to be appointed by circuit court judges. While some argued that judges are best suited to determine who is best qualified for the job, critics worried that the process makes public defenders too beholden to the judges. The new law establishes a different system, one in which the commission would ultimately appoint many county public defenders who would be limited to 10-year terms. Another requirement included in the law is collecting information to determine reasonable public defender caseloads, a data point that varies depending on the size of the county. That would include determining the number of attorneys and staff members at different county public defender offices, how much money the counties have spent on expert witnesses or other outside help, and the costs of office space, technology, and equipment. There are similar counties that share public defenders and hire contract attorneys. One contract attorney from Southern Illinois last year told the Tribune that he had been working in as many as 3 counties, and in one of those jurisdictions, he was tasked with representing most of the defendants in 75 to 100 felony cases per year. While the new statewide office will be available to public defenders in every county, it will likely be most beneficial to smaller rural counties in Illinois, which often have some of the fewest resources in the state. For largely rural South Central Montgomery County, population 28,000, Chief Public Defender Aaron Madison has an associate public defender, a receptionist, and an office manager who also works as a paralegal. There are also a couple of contract lawyers on hand in case Mattson or her associates has any conflicts of interest in a case. Mattson said she alone handles some 500 cases, at least 200 of which are felonies that run the gamut from selling methamphetamine and residential burglaries to child pornography. For Logan County's chief public defender, Kirk Schoenbein, the verdict is still out on the new law. Downstate, I think there's just a distrust of large bureaucratic agencies from the state, he said. And that is really better than me being accountable to a local judge who understands my situation. But he also described a system in Logan County where private criminal defense attorneys are scarce, leaving his office with the responsibility of handling most of the county's serious criminal cases. Schoenbein said he thinks his office, he's the only full-time attorney, along with three part-timers and a handful of contract lawyers, sees roughly 250 to 280 new felony cases a year, with about 80 to 90% of those cases handled by his team. Back in the Urbana courtroom, Judge Olmstead turned his attention to the case of Melinda Strong, a 30-year-old woman arrested for felony retail theft. The judge noted she had a prior theft conviction and could now face a prison sentence of 2 to 10 years. Strong had previously been represented by the public defender's office, and Ticknor, the assistant public defender, was in court on her behalf in the new case, which stemmed from an incident at the Meyer grocery store. Strong pleaded not guilty but was ordered to remain in custody. Strong's brother, Keith Hocombe, was in court and said he hoped she would stay out of trouble. I mean, she wants to get out and do right. I mean, I'm there for her, Hocombe, who said he was raised in Chicago but now lives in Champaign County, told a Tribune reporter outside of court. I mean, when she does get up out of there, she's got to do right. Hocombe, 33, acknowledged public defenders are a necessity because without them, he'd be unable to afford a lawyer for his sister. Hocombe said he's on disability and much of the money he has must be set aside for rent and utility. It's just a tough time. We're poor right now, Hocombe said. If I had the money, shoot, I'd hire a lawyer, I mean, but I don't have it, though. Next, from the Chicago Tribune, we have guard use stirs black trauma. Trump rhetoric reminds Chicagoans of historic tension and fear of police, by Darcel Rocket and Tess Kenny. Jada Parker is on edge these days. The 26-year-old is cautious while commuting from her Washington Park apartment to work in the Loop. She keeps a lock on the driving wheel of her car and is usually indoors by the time the sun sets. But with talk that President Donald Trump might deploy the National Guard to Chicago, Parker, who is black, has been reminding herself to stay on her best behavior. It just makes me completely nervous, she said. Since sending the National Guard to Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. earlier this year, Trump has repeatedly threatened to deploy troops to Chicago under the guise of combating crime, despite the fact that, according to city and county figures, Chicago was poised to close the first half of the year with its steepest statistical drop in crime in recent memory. But as Trump toys with the idea of militarizing some of the country's most democratic cities, in turn testing the limits of presidential power, the idea of increased law enforcement patrolling the city's neighborhood weighs heavily on Chicago's black communities, whose relationship with law enforcement is rooted in historical tensions and present-day fear. For residents of primarily black neighborhoods on the south and west sides, terms like Operation Midway Blitz, Death Trap, Shipocalypse Now, all of the phrases Trump administration has used when talking about Chicago amid this month's immigration crackdown, can be detrimental, say mental health professionals, community leaders, and everyday residents. It's frightening, said Parker, a lifelong Chicagoan. With federal immigration agents already crawling across the city, detaining people going to work, dropping their kids off at school, or going to court, it's nerve-wracking. I'm a black woman, and even if I'm not necessarily the target, I fear that I might see that happening, and then I don't know what to do, she said. Am I cowering out by not doing anything? Do I film? Am I going to be retaliated against? The National Guard in the city is not new. A review of the Tribune archives found 18 events in which the governor activated the National Guard within Chicago. Two of them, both during the 19th century, involved a sitting U.S. president who acted in coordination with the governor. But if it happens under Trump, it's over the objections of a sitting governor who has already threatened a legal battle. Governor J.B. Pritzker has also mocked Trump's wavering threats, saying recently that you can take anything he says seriously from one day to the next. He's attacking verbally. Sometimes he attacks, sending his agents in. Sometimes he forgets. I think he might be suffering from some dementia. The next day, he'll wake up on the other side of the bed and stop talking about Chicago. Pritzker, an ardent critic of Trump and potential 2028 White House aspirant, said of the president. Still, will he or won't he? Discussion becomes the greatest frustration, said Karen Freeman Wilson, president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League. Anyone could become Trump's next target, she said. Creating chaos doesn't respect the law or the concept of due process. It's simply disrespectful to the people who live in a democracy, and it's intentionally so. It is not an accident. The Reverend Marshall Hatch Sr. calls it traumatizing. The senior pastor of the new Mount Pilgrim Missionary Baptist Church of West Garfield was living in the former Jane Addams homes on the city's Near West Side when the National Guard was deployed in 1968. The Reverend Martin Luther King had just been assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, and Hatch was 10 years old at the time. King's murder had sparked riots across the country. In Chicago, on the first night of rioting, 9 people, all black, were killed. 2 days later, with the approval of Mayor Richard J. Daley, thousands of troops descended on the city's most troubled areas. I remember seeing soldiers going up and down the street and chaos across the west side, he said, and as a resident of public housing and maybe feeling somewhat unprotected. It felt like under occupation as a little kid, said Hatch, especially when Daley gave his infamous police order to shoot to kill against arsonists. Now, with the present threat, it almost feels like hour by hour, there's this ominous sort of bracing for what's to come, Hatch said. Jalen Hughes, 18, was born and raised in Chicago and lives in Inglewood. The Noble Academy High School student said Trump has it all wrong about the city. Trump is making it feel like it's a war zone, but it's really not, Hughes said on a recent afternoon as he stood on a sidewalk in River North. These are people's homes. You can't just come in and do what you want to do just because you have power. That doesn't make sense. The fear folks have now is rational and appropriate, considering the National Guard's history, according to Elizabeth Todd Breland, a history professor at the University of Illinois in Chicago. She said that historically people viewed the National Guard as defenders of civil rights, particularly in the South when troops were called in to force desegregation in education. However, that perspective changed in the 1960s, she said, when the troops were used to suppress demonstrations and target black protesters who rose up against deep systemic injustices. It's the black people who have borne the brunt of over-policing in our neighborhoods. I think there are many black folks who have a very strong aversion to that. And with that, I conclude the reading of part one of the Pantograph for Tuesday, September 30th, 2025. I'm Janice Schweizer, and I will return shortly with part two.